hits your eye like a big pizza pie. That's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling.
You've joined the Big Max Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented Moonstruck. I'm watching it with me is Catherine Lowe. Hi, Catherine, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you, Rich?
I'm good, and thank you for bringing your Betamax copy of the multi-Oscar-winning Moonstruck. Now, we always ask this question, but what's so special about this film for you?
Well, I first saw this film in my teens, and I thought it was lovely and funny, though I'm not sure I dwelt on it much at the time. And then I saw it again more recently, and I feel like it hit me differently once I'd had more things happen to me in my own life. It's interesting, as rom-coms of the 80s and 90s go, I think Moonstruck has been a bit eclipsed. When people list the big ones from around that time, you more often hear about When Harry Met Sally and Pretty Woman and Dirty Dancing. Maybe it's because this rom-com is a bit unconventional in that it's about predominantly older people who've already been through some stuff, and it makes you laugh, but it's also quite melancholy. It has lots of great things to say about living for the moment and acting on your passions, but it doesn't leave you with a sense that love is going to solve all your problems. But it is loads of fun, and it's got Nicolas Cage storming around eating steak and spaghetti, and Cher giving us the ultimate makeover scene. And it's quite sexy in its own crazy way. So it's got all the ingredients for a Betamax classic, I think.
I think so, and I'll get this out of the way first. And I know we talked about this sort of by WhatsApp and stuff, but having never seen this film before, and it's, of course, shocking and controversial and everything like that, and sitting down watching it last night or night before we're recording this.
Yeah.
And it's not very often I come out of a film having seen it on, you know, on TV and just thinking... And I think the word I used to describe it was delightful.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because normally the films I watch for this, they're Rambo or Schwarzenegger or something ridiculous with Tom Hanks or Chuck Norris or something. And to sit there and watch a film about, as you say, people in various stages of life finding love, being in love, and I mean, that being the main thing, but it was actually very funny as well, and you know, seeing a lot of faces and people pop up that you go, oh wow, you know, that's so and so from, you know, previous TV show or film.
Yeah.
And coming out of it thinking, you know, this film won, I think, was it 3 Oscars?
Yes.
And you think it was great because, you know, When Harry Met Sally, the one you said, I mean, that was immediately one that you kind of see as almost a peer to this. And yet this, it's amazing. I haven't seen it. Very rarely does it pop up on telly, and yet it's always one of these that's on the list. You know, when people do lists of their favourite films of an era or rom-coms or anything like that, it always comes really highly. And I mean, it's almost a shame on myself for that, but I mean, thank you so much for recommending it, because I really enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased. Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose it's just that, I mean, it's quite, it makes you realise how rare it is when you see a comedy when almost all the cast are over 40. Like most of the films that we watch now are usually, well, if they're kind of romantic comedies of this genre, they're about much younger people. And also the fact that I think Cher was 40 when she was filming this, and Nicolas Cage was in his mid-20s, so there's 18 years between the two of them, and that's a really rare thing to see when, you know, you see that with a pairing in a romantic comedy or a romantic film in general, when the man is the much older one. But it's very, very unusual to see it this way around, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I mean it is something that, you know, watching it with modern eyes as we are, and I mean we're 33 years god later, you know, we're coming at this and it is obvious that there is an age gap, and obviously, you know, we know there's an age gap, which is a big thing. But you know, the fact is, it doesn't really play a part in it at all. I mean, you've got yes, there are people of different generations. You've got Cher or Loretta, her parents, her grandparent or her dad's dad living in the house, and her fiance and his brother. You know, that there's nothing to do with the age, and the fact that Ronnie and Johnny I think the actors in real life, Nicolas Cage and Danny Aiello, they're, I think it was a 30, 31 years age difference. You know, they're playing brothers. It's, you wouldn't get away with it now.
No, it's
crazy. I mean, like, the age gap between me and my youngest brother is 13 years, and people go, oh my God, that's really crazy.
Yeah.
And yet coming now, you know, it's something that I used to ask a lot on the podcast of guests, so I don't do it anymore. But when you think about if this film was made now, if this screenplay just emerged, you know, how would you do it? And you think if, you know, Cher was in her, she was 40, early 40s. How would you do that now? It's almost, that would be the million-dollar question of Hollywood, is who would you put in that role to play opposite someone in their early 20s, but not as a, inverted commas, cougar?
No, you're so right. If it was made now and that age gap was between them, that would be the focus of the film, wouldn't it? That would be the focus of the narrative. That would be the thing that was meant to be remarkable. And so either... And if it wasn't, then, yeah, they'd be wanting to recast that role. And it is really, like, I think the most romantic scene in the whole film, actually. And I think one of the most romantic scenes that I've seen in a romantic comedy is between her aunt and uncle when they're looking out at the full moon. And she says, oh, when you look at me in that light, you look like you're 25 years old. And I was thinking, it's also really rare that you see scenes like that in films, in mainstream films, where elderly people, are being shone a light on in that way, in a way that, you know, shows that they, you know, they still have love lives. They're still sort of in love. They're still sexually active. They're still vibrant. You know, they have all of this beautiful history between them. And, you know, it's something that I think you don't see enough of in film, really.
No, and it's just, you know, looking at the cast, and I mean, I didn't realise that the director of the film, Norman Jewison, I mean, he's directed an eclectic group of films himself. I mean, you know, one of my favourite films, The Thomas Crown Affair, the original one.
Yes.
With Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway, and yet he's done this, and In the Heat of the Night, and Fiddler on the Roof, and all these films, and he's come to this, and he's brought, and I mean, I can really only compare it to, I say The Thomas Crown Affair because I've seen it so many times, and yet he still brought the same kind of, you know, charm and quality to that, where it's fun. Yeah, and this is what films are supposed to be, they're fun. Yes, there's a bit of peril, there's a bit of, you know, will they, won't they, all that, but you've ultimately, it's so light and it's so complimentary, and no one really gets hurt, and no one, you know, spoiler alert, when she makes her decision at the end, the person she doesn't choose is still warmly invited in because he's still part of the family.
Yes.
And there's it's great.
It's completely great. And he directs it with a real, he knows exactly how to bring the best out of all of those incredible actors. Like there's a scene between Cher and her father towards the beginning of the film where she's telling him that she's going to marry Johnny, and it's done under this really sort of stark overhead light, exactly the kind that you have, you know, when you go and have a chat with someone in your kitchen about something at that time. And another thing, the way he lights the love scene between the two of them when he goes and carries her onto the bed, Nicolas Cage and Cher, is also sort of lit in this really unusual way where, you know, it's not all kind of candlelight and soft music, like, you know, with Take My Breath Away playing in the background. It's all kind of done in this quite real way. He really lets you kind of feel with them as all of this drama is playing out, and I think it kind of touches you in quite a personal way, rather than you watching it like one does quite a lot of 80s films, where you feel one step removed and you're kind of just, you know, enjoying the sort of cheesiness of it. Whereas when you're watching Moonstruck, even though it is very, very romantic and escapist in some ways, it also feels quite earthy.
And there's an element of it where, you know, I mean, most of the actors in it, the cast in it are portrayed as Italian or Italian-American and have that Italian heritage. And yet, you know, it's not parodied at all. There is, I mean, they speak in Italian here and there, and there's a lot of the phrasing, but it's not made a huge deal of, other than, you know, Johnny flies to Sicily to see his dying mother, and, you know, that's there, but it's not a huge thing. I mean, you know, from my point of view, watching this, and, you know, most of my family are Irish, it could quite easily be Irish. And
yes, my family are Irish too, and I was thinking exactly the same thing. That's so funny.
You know, so transferable. You know, this isn't something, and I mean, yes, it's, I mean, parts of it, and what we've talked about previously off air about, you know, one of the big recurring themes of this film is food.
Yes.
And how the food, yes, it's very Italian, but it's just such a fantastic motif that runs through it, where you see this film, you look at coffee pots and go, oh wow, you know, that looks great. Or the, you know, we talked about the eggs in the bread, or the peppers and sausages and all this stuff. And yes, a couple of pivotal scenes are based around an Italian restaurant, just to kind of ram it home a little bit.
Yes.
But it's done so carefully that you can watch it and feel warm about it without going, oh God, you know, thank you. This isn't Mrs. Brown's Boys, where they're really hitting you over the head with it over and over again. And mm-hmm. And I apologise to anyone who takes offence at the fact that I've just used Moonstruck and Mrs. Brown's Boys in the same sentence.
No, it's so true. And things like that final scene when they're all sitting around the kitchen table eating the oatmeal together. And yeah, it's the food just has that feeling of it being part of the kind of foundation of the family, and also how you welcome someone into your life. Like, you have Cher's Cara di Loretta cooking Ronnie that steak with spaghetti. And in a way, you know, in a way, when you watch it after having seen what plays out, you kind of think, oh, in a strange way, that's kind of like this sort of no-nonsense sort of foreplay, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
I'm going to make you this very bloody steak and, you know, sort of slam it in front of you, and then you're going to tell me what you think, you know, we'll have whiskey.
It's like a sort of man thing. It's like she describes him as being a wolf and then feeds him this bloody steak and they end up, like, take me to the bed. It's so, there is still that element of the woman cooking for the man, but, you know, she's just as in control as he is. And I mean, he's totally, you know, despite him sweeping her off her feet physically, she does it to him. I mean, you know, I suppose to most people in their early 20s, if you're Nicolas Cage and Cher comes along, I mean, it's all very strange, you know, it's his estranged brother's fiance that he's just met, but it just seems, it doesn't seem ridiculous the way that they get together.
No, the chemistry is very convincing. And something about that scene was, I heard that originally when he first kisses her, when he draws away from her, it was meant to show her having blood on her lips because he kissed her so passionately. That was kind of to mimic the steak. And then in the end, they decided against that because they thought it would be too much. But I kind of love that was the original intention. And you're so right about her kind of holding all the cards ultimately. A scene that I really like that comes later, one of the most famous scenes, is the scene where he says, I'm in love with you, and she slaps him and says, snap out of it. It's just so great because you do kind of think, oh God, I see that so rarely in films like this. Usually you have the kind of morning after, and the man takes off and the woman is left an emotional wreck, you know, going, why won't he call me? Whereas with this one, it's kind of the opposite, where he's kind of going, come to the opera, let me romance you. And she's saying, no, we must be practical, you know. And so I do like the way he has to win her over on that front.
I guess that's an age thing, I guess. I mean, if I was taking myself back to being 22, 23, 24, and if I was sort of swept by an older woman, I'd probably be a little bit crazy and smitten. I mean, Nicolas Cage, you know, he's almost become a parody of himself in recent years, where he's almost transcended being a meme.
But,
you know, and he went through that golden spell in the sort of mid to late 90s of all those films where he, again, was just about playing, let's say even then he was still mental. But you could see here that the sort of beginnings of that, where he's extravagant, he wears his heart on his sleeve, he's very emotional. I mean, you know, the scene that you kind of nudged me towards when they first met in the basement of his bakery.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like something, again, out of an opera. The way his mannerisms and the way he speaks and the way he shouts at people, that, you know, these watchers of him almost putting on a performance. I mean, it's just crazy, and you kind of see where he's taken it since. And, yeah, I mean, at least we've got this preserved on video or Betamax or whatever, that we can go back and see, yes, this is when he was brilliant and not completely mad.
Chrissy, over by the wall, bring me the big knife.
No, Ronnie!
Bring me the big knife! I'm gonna cut my throat!
Maybe I should come back another time.
No, I want you to see this. I want you to watch me kill myself so you can tell my brother Johnny on his wedding day, okay? Chrissy, bring me the big knife!
I tell you, I won't do it!
It's a really interesting performance because it's somehow, even though he's sort of ranting and raving, it doesn't ever have any kind of real sort of scary aggression to it. Like, you know, it has touches of Marlon Brando, Stanley Kowalski and A Streetcar Named Desire or something, but then it also occasionally has a sort of like elements of Ross Geller having an episode about his sandwich or something, you know. It kind of has that element of just like, look, I'm just so unhappy with the world and I'm just going to irrationally blame whoever I want to right now because I'm just so unhappy. You know, it's got that kind of crazed vulnerability to it. And yeah, it never feels like he overpowers her, even though he's so strong. Yeah.
You know, the whole premise is that Loretta Cher is a widow and she meets Johnny, who he seems, and he's almost described, wherever I read him, as like a man baby. He's still a mama's boy. He's still very much in his own world. And he proposes to her in this restaurant, which is almost like a mainstay of the community, where everyone knows everyone. And, you know, she really puts the pressure on him to do it properly. And she's a big believer in bad luck, where, you know, he has to propose, he should kneel down, where's the ring? And he ends up giving her this pinky ring that he wears. And all this stuff where she's, you know, we've seen in the opening scene, she's a bookkeeper, so she's not a housewife. She's not a woman who needs looking after. You know, she's got an important job. She's being 40-ish. She's living her life. You know, she doesn't need this man, but it's almost what she does. But yeah, the way that they portray him as this man-child is, in a slightly different generation or in a different country, he'd probably be sitting there in jeans and classic sort of Adidas trainers and a hoodie going, what?
No, completely. No, it's funny, isn't it, how generations do distort these things, because he looks, when you're watching the film initially, he looks like such a grown-up in some ways, you know, retrospectively. But yeah, I heard John Patrick Shanley talk about her Loretta's viewpoint on that, and he said something really interesting, which that he said Loretta originally wants to be practical by marrying a man she doesn't love, but life is impractical because it ultimately ends in death. So it doesn't pay to operate by common sense. And no. I've been thinking ever since I heard that, I thought that's such a good point. You know, it's like this idea that she was thinking that by marrying a man like Johnny, she can just, you know, sort of cut out all the kind of the drama and the pain in life, because she doesn't love him, you know, but he seems perfectly nice, which he is, you know, you can see that he's a perfectly nice man. But because every life for us all, one way or the other, ends messily, and it has so much messiness about it, that in a way it's not necessarily a good idea to go down that road.
No, because again, that's the question that gets asked a couple of times throughout the film is, you know, if you love someone, you don't marry them because it gets messy, and it's not necessarily the ingredients for a good marriage, because I guess it's a particular point of view. But, you know, if you're going to have this tempestuous relationship, then, you know, maybe you don't need the constraints of marriage, as some people would call it, you know, obviously if certain people are listening, I thoroughly believe in the institution. But if, you know, and again, when she's talking to Ronnie later on, it's going to get confusing, Johnny and Ronnie, the brothers.
Yeah, it is confusing. Yeah.
And, you know, she says, do you love him? Yes. Oh, no. You know, that's the worst thing, because they know full well, it's like, oh God, it's going to be like that. It's not this kind of content situation where they're going to be all happily ever after. This is going to be wild. It's going to be crazy.
No, exactly. And it culminates in one of the greatest lines, with, you know, from her mother, which is, you've got a love bite on your neck. Your life's going down the toilet. Absolutely love that line so much. So funny. But yeah, as a film, I think that that's its real strength, but also maybe why it's not sort of put up there in the kind of the escapist sort of category that people refer to, because it gives you various perspectives on love, doesn't it? You get to live through the kind of the gorgeous wild idea of falling in love via Loretta and Ronnie, but then you also get given this melancholy tale of where marriage and, you know, just falling in love can lead you. Via her mum and dad, and so in a way, as a film, it kind of gives you two different arguments, or perhaps you could even sort of say that it sort of shows you what happens after the honeymoon period, quite possibly, or what can happen rather. Not that it's inevitable, of course it's not, because actually you see through her aunt and uncle that people can get married and they can be incredibly happy together until they die, you know. So it just gives you different perspectives, I think.
And one of the things, you know, again, keeping an eye out on the food on this, when the morning after the proposal and Johnny's gone off to Sicily for his dying mother, and Loretta comes down and her mum makes her this breakfast, and it is the eggs in the bread. There's the moka pots on the stove for the coffee. It's everything's there, you know. Again, it's that kind of Irish-Italian thing where there's full cupboards and the cooker's always going, and there's always a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, depending which one you are, which side.
Yes.
And watching this, you kind of think, you know, if I went back to my mum's house now, I know I'd always have, albeit slightly not the same, but I'd always have a cup of tea and a bacon sandwich within 5 minutes away and stuff. There's always that kind of welcoming, homely thing, and I don't know if my mum would be quite so dispensing with the wisdom, other than your hair looks ridiculous or you look tired or something like that. But it's that's kind of what that kind of mother is, and that's kind of what, if you don't have it, or if you've lost it or whatever, then you miss it, because it's portrayed so well. And Olympia Dukakis, again, Oscar winning in this role, you know, really comes across. And you see this early on and throughout the film, as you said, her story of love is kind of portrayed as well, in that she is aware that her husband's having an affair. I mean, I don't think they said how long they were married, but you've got to assume at least 40, 45 years.
Yeah.
And it's sad, because while she has this brief flirtation with Fraser's dad, that's what I call him. you know, ultimately, she still accepts what's going on, as long as the dad, Cosmo, great name, refuses to carry on the affair. You know, it is melancholy and it is sad the way that she has a brief glimpse at something else, but she knows where her heart is and what she needs to kind of carry on.
Yes, exactly. And she really does come across as an incredible woman. You really get frustrated with Vincent Gardini's character for not kind of appreciating her more, because she's this incredible cook and she's clearly clever and, you know, quick-witted and all of these things. And as you say, there's something about the fact that she's nurturing, you know, cooking for the family, making sure that everything's running okay, while carrying all this pain. There's a real pathos in that, and you can see that she's really worrying about her daughter as well. You know, once it's clear that her daughter isn't going to take the safe route of marrying a man that she's not very emotionally involved with, you can see that she's quite distressed about that too. And yeah, I think that's the thing. In a way, you get she's kind of the second the second lead of the film, actually. I think that you see everything through her eyes almost as much as you do through Loretta's.
Yeah. And you know, throughout there's the elements of the dad sort of being reluctant to pay for the wedding, and, you know, it turns out he's a plumber who's he's quite well off, you know, what can we say? He's a plumber, he's in the trade.
Yes. And they live in a nice house.
Mm.
That, you know, it's this idea of a kind of family that have been in the city for a very long time, and they're almost kind of, you know, the family themselves are one of the lovely buildings in the town that's sort of grown around them. And he's such a convincing character. There's so much conflict within him, and that scene at the end between him and Rose where he says, you know, my life is built on nothing, and she says, your life is not built on nothing. You know, it's so painful to watch, but you can see the real connection between them. And he's got contradictions in that. One thing that I do quite like is that when Loretta comes to him and says that she's going to marry Johnny, he says, don't marry Johnny, Johnny's a baby. You know, he's not just one of these fathers that are just telling his daughter to marry whoever, you know, comes along. You can see that he sort of agrees with Rose about the fact that Johnny isn't necessarily sort of someone that's incredibly impressive as a guy, you know. So
yeah, he's probably a provider, but that's about it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
He's not a wolf like his brother.
No. And I do like the fact that her parents don't look as if they're sort of falling over themselves for her to just kind of, you know, marry whoever will have her, and then so you can kind of see that they love her in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I glossed over a little bit around the whole meeting of Ronnie in the bakery, Johnny's brother, and is this scene, the whole element of why they've fallen out is because when Johnny went to see Ronnie at the bakery, and it was all about his bride, and he was only 18, and he lost part of his hand in a slicer because he wasn't paying attention. He's almost held this sort of blood curse. You know, yes. They've fallen out because of this thing. It's a very operatic kind of thing where he's like, you've something out of an old play where, you know, you hold a grudge against someone for something that to most sane people would seem ridiculous, and yet to him it's the biggest thing in the world. And yet if you're slaving away in this bakery, and I must give a shout out because the customer in the bakery upstairs when Loretta was in there was Martin Scorsese's mum.
Oh, wow. Who always pops
up in everything. I wouldn't expect to see her in this because, again, you know, she's been in most of Scorsese's films at some point. I mean, she was Joe Pesci's mum in Goodfellas.
Yeah.
And to see her in this bakery here was nice. But, you know, this whole thing where Ronnie walks around with a prosthetic hand, you know, just kind of there to almost club you over the head with the fact that this is the reason he holds this grudge against his brother. It's, you know, you see that from everything from, yeah, old plays to Star Wars, where people have got prosthetic hands because of blood grudges and all that stuff. It's all very weird.
Yes, yes, you're right. It's very heightened. It's so operatic, isn't it? It's, yeah.
And Nicolas Cage just plays it. Yeah, as we've said already, it's just that right side of believable and endearing, because any more and he'd become his character in Face Off, which was quite scary at times.
I haven't seen Face Off, is it?
Oh.
You recommend it?
It's almost an 80s film. It's Nicolas Cage at his peak, John Travolta at the peak of his comeback, trying to outdo each other in the mad stakes. And they swap faces. So if I don't know if I can sell that any better. It's an acquired taste. It's very popular, and rightly so. But some people with taste will watch it and go, what the hell is this? Yeah.
Well, I like John Travolta as well, so I should definitely watch that.
Yeah, essentially it's Nicolas Cage is playing John Travolta and John Travolta is playing Nicolas Cage.
Oh,
it's crazy.
Oh, wow. Oh, that is, yeah, that sounds fantastic. Oh, that, speaking of which, actually, the aunt in Moonstruck, who's Julie Bevasso, played by Julie Bevasso, is John Travolta's mum in Saturday Night Fever, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, so it was funny, like, I remember that had been the first time I saw the moment in this film where she sort of sat around the dinner table with the rest of them, thinking, I'm sure I've seen her sat around a dinner table in another film before. And it's, yeah, it was because it was Saturday Night Fever where the kind of the shot looked quite similar. So,
yeah. Yeah. Ah, what a small world.
I know, exactly.
Yeah, and one scene from this which is, I guess where the title of the film comes is where they're talking about the dinner, where they're talking about this big moon and love and how, you know, it's quite literally a giant moon. It's, I mean, I suppose now in this age it's hashtag supermoon or something like that, but where the light of the moon inspires people to fall in love and reconsider their love. And as you said, the aunt and the uncle, you know, have a tender moment, and it probably gets a lot more tender off camera, but he says you look 25 again.
Yeah.
You know, and they do hammer it home for a couple of minutes, but it's really nicely done. You know, you've got the couples in this, I call it a play, because it is like a play in that way, yeah, where how they're interacting because of this moon, where, you know, Ronnie and Loretta are in, they've been in bed and they're looking out the window, staring at this supermoon, and it's all very nice and one of those kind of moments where it puts everyone together in the same time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you're all sharing in the kind of the magic of what's happening. It's such a that scene between the aunt and the uncle, really, I don't know about you, but it really destroys me. It really makes me well up. I don't think it did when I saw it when I was younger, and now I think in a way it's kind of the best argument that the film makes for you know, settling down with someone that you love, because you think, oh, you know, that could be me and another person when we're older, and that would be so lovely, you know.
Yeah. But then there's the cynical side that thinks, oh, when you get to that age you barely tolerate each other and you probably sleep in separate beds.
Oh, come on.
Watch too much Fawlty Towers or something like that.
I've watched an awful lot of Fawlty Towers too. you have to balance these things out, don't you?
you need a reminder that not everyone is bad, and some people are nice, and you know, don't have to be cynical about everything.
Completely. They've got that lovely, another wonderful scene is the scene where Loretta is on her way back from Ronnie's place, and she's just walking down the street on her own, kicking a can, and you've got Puccini playing in the background, and it just really captures, I think, that moment when you're falling for someone and you're on cloud nine, and you know, it just, and everything else sort of falls away.
I mean, I wonder, I've only been to Brooklyn once briefly. It was kind of it was one of those things when you're in New York, you walk across the bridge, have an ice cream and go back again. But I mean, I wonder if, was Brooklyn portrayed in the way that maybe like Notting Hill is or something like that, where completely differently to how it is in real life, but you see it here and it, I guess it's a different time, but walking around Brooklyn doing, you know, what some people would call a walk of shame, kicking a can around looking, you know, at least it's not a walk of shame because she looks happy.
Yeah, whenever I've done the Walk of Shame, I don't think I've looked like Cher does in that scene, I have to say. She does look pretty incredible, considering, yeah.
you haven't had your hair done the night before anymore.
Oh, I might have had my hair done the night before, but it wouldn't. Yeah. Hers looks like she hasn't slept on it, so.
I mean, that's one of the things, you know, where she's agreed to go to the opera with Ronnie, to almost as a kind of bookend to their fling. He's asked her very nicely. He said, "Oh, if you go to the opera with me, I'll never hassle you again." Which is, you know, I guess if you look at that through modern eyes, it's, you know, very unpleasant behaviour, and it's blackmail and all sorts. I mean, there's probably what the kids call it, gaslighting in there or something like that. But you know, I mean,
no, I know what you mean.
But this is the thing where, you know, Cher she goes through this, you know, she has this mini makeover where her hair is done because it's deliberately portrayed. I mean, you know, she had the obvious grey hair at the front, and she has her eyebrows done and makeup done. And she comes out of the hairdresser's with this enormous hairdo.
Yes.
And then she's at home trying on these new shoes and clothes and stuff. It's almost like a sort of butterfly coming out of a chrysalis.
Yes. Another, I heard, I think it was Norman Jewison talking about this, and this is another really interesting thing that's got me thinking, is that he said, when women get their hair dyed, you know, etc., it's an affirmation of life, whereas when men do it, it's a denial of death. That's you know, it's, I mean, obviously that's a very generalized quote, and he wouldn't have meant it in any particular way, but just that idea of it made me think about makeover scenes in 80s films. And I think because now we've started to dissect them in recent years, thinking about, you know, why women need to be given these makeovers in films when men don't, you know. Although, actually, I was just thinking about it, and Gene Wilder does have a really good makeover scene in The Woman in Red.
Yeah, that's true.
But generally speaking, yeah, this idea that when men have a big makeover scene in a film, like in Woman in Red, it's sort of played for laughs quite often, whereas with women, you know, it's like at the end of The Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
Clueless, or in all of these films, you know, there's this idea that, as you say, coming out of a chrysalis. But with this film as well, I think there was meant to be an added feeling of impact because it's Cher, and everyone already knew Cher as this sort of singing starlet, this chameleon. And so when you first start watching this film, you're aware of the fact that it's Cher, and she's sort of, you know, being put in these quite plain clothes, and you're hoping that at some point she'll transform into the Cher, you know, the sort of fabulous, the fabulous image that we're all familiar with. And then at the point where she does, it feels exciting for the audience, you know, because it's kind of Cher becoming Cher before your eyes. And I was thinking that's quite an interesting perspective to look at it from.
Tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be Cher.
Yeah, because I mean, this whole makeover thing, I mean, without meaning to date this too much, I mean, she may well have just had issues not being able to get her hair done during lockdown or anything like that, where the hairdresser has been closed. And
oh, well, I can't relate to that at all.
Coming out of, I think it was about 5 months before I had a haircut during that whole period, and I could actually put my hair in a ponytail at the end, which is when I said earlier, my mum said, your hair looks gross. That was exactly what she said when
when she
saw the before picture and not the after. But it was, you know, coming out, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who'd watch that now and relate to it. But yeah,
yes,
I mean, I guess that's the thing with, you know, Cher. And I guess maybe this is something we don't have in the modern age quite so much anyway, is the idea of this massive icon where, you know, it's Cher, you know, in the way that, you know, she has one word like Madonna or Pele. But
I know,
you know, she's Cher in the mid 80s. Everyone knew who she was from some era or another. And even now, I mean, she's playing Meryl Streep's mum in a Mamma Mia sequel or something. It's she's still going, and she's, everyone knows who Cher is, and that's kind of, as you say, the point where it's almost like a Clark Kent Superman thing. We're almost expecting, right, when's she going to change? When is she going to turn into Super Cher?
Yes, yes, you know, completely.
It's crazy, and especially when you see the outfit that she turned up to the Oscars in. That's not the outfit. A bookkeeper wears.
It's an amazingly memorable outfit, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she is extraordinary, the way she transforms into these different kind of images before your eyes. Because I think of her as that era of Cher and in that Oscar outfit and being terribly glamorous. And then the other day I watched the Mike Nichols film Silkwood that she's in with Meryl Streep, and throughout that entire film, she's wearing no makeup, and she's giving the most fantastic pared down performance you can possibly imagine. And I was kind of thinking, wow, you know, Cher's a really good actor, and she completely commits to whatever it is that she's doing, whether it be, you know, singing in sequins or starring in quite a low budget Mike Nichols film. So she's really, have you ever seen her one woman West Side Story?
No. Oh, that sounds fabulous.
She does. She had a Cher special on TV in the late 70s, and she did a mini version of West Side Story where she plays all the roles.
Oh, wow.
So I think, you know, that just says it all about Cher. No, and I watched the clip of her accepting the Oscar as preparation for this, and she kissed a man next to her, and I thought, oh, he's cute. I wonder who he is. And then it turned out that at the time, she was dating a man who was also 18 years younger than her, who worked in a bakery. So she was basically dating real-life Ronnie, which is amazing. But I thought even that, like, it was quite hard to find out. And I thought it was wonderful, actually, with Cher, how actually her private life and anything like that about her isn't the thing that people focus on in the way that they would do with so many celebrities these days. That you're right, she's just this standalone kind of incredible performer. And even that even comes across in the way that this film was marketed, because you've got that film, a really good film poster. I love it when you've got a really good film poster to promote a film, her dancing in front of the moon, and it's just her, rather than it being kind of about, you know, the pairing. And even that shows how powerful she was at the time and continues to be. You know, she's just a standalone icon, and you know that in itself will sell your film. You know,
I mean, it's again, you know, comparing it to Madonna, which is a bit like chalk and cheese in some ways. But on the recent episode about Desperately Seeking Susan, which was Madonna at a very different phase of her career, and only came out.
I can't wait to hear that episode.
A bit before this, and there was, I mean, Madonna's not an actress at all. Well, she is, but, you know, that's not her main skill.
You mean.
But the home video or the poster for Desperately Seeking Susan, I think one of the quotes from a critic was, in inverted commas, that Madonna movie. And it was kind of, is that a passive-aggressive thing? Or is it, you know, he's just stating a point? And that, but whereas, you know, they can quite happily market a film. And yes, this wasn't the big film of the year. You know, you think, you look at some of the higher budget stuff. I mean, I think this was competing at the Oscars with The Last Emperor and things like that. And even when I had a look at the list, because bear in mind, I don't look at many films that have won Oscars. And one of the other films that I have done recently that was nominated for a few at this ceremony was RoboCop, weirdly. You know, this would quite happily put a picture of Cher on a film cover or on a poster. When you're used to, if you see one person on a film poster, it's normally Arnold Schwarzenegger or something like that, and you've got Cher dancing in front of the moonlight. I mean, yes, this isn't a rival to Predator in any way, shape or form, but this is how comfortable they are. And yet they're still, if you look at Google and various, I read a few different articles about how the film was made and some of the stories behind it, and how originally the film was written with Sally Field in mind, and how Cher threatened to quit when they were sort of wavering over casting Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, she really fought for him, didn't she?
Yeah, and you think about how, and I guess it's the same of a lot of films that go on to do great things or be remembered for great things, is that, you know, it's not always goes that easily. It goes, there's always some drama behind the scenes. There's always a, you know, someone steps into the lead role at the last minute and end up walking up with an Oscar. It's one of these that, yes, things weren't smooth, but, you know, to come out with Cher and Olympia Dukakis winning acting Oscars and best screenplay.
Yeah.
It just shows, you know, and it is sad that it doesn't get remembered as much. But hopefully, I think I saw recently that during the whole lockdown thing, there was one of these big tweet along a movie thing where everyone watches a film at the same time. And this was one, I think, one of the popular US websites or culture magazines did a watch along for this. And it was massive. You know, Moonstruck was trending in the UK because people were doing it at the same time. It was, I think, the way that the time zone worked out probably helped. But, you know, people were really getting involved with this. And yet it kind of drops in and out of Netflix. And you know, I can't remember last time I even saw it publicised on being on telly in the UK anyway. But it's crazy that, you know, for, you know, and I'll admit, you know, yes, I'm not a Cher fan, and yeah. I haven't seen most of her films, and the film that I've seen her most in, and even, I don't think she was on screen, was Groundhog Day, when you hear her voice several times over.
Oh yes, of course. Yeah.
But it's crazy that this film won her an Oscar, and yet I hadn't seen it before. But then, let's be fair, I hadn't seen Blade Runner before I saw that a couple of years ago, so that's my fault, not anyone else's.
She won against, I mean, I think it was a really strong category, and one of the people that she won against was Glenn Close for Fatal Attraction. And yeah. To win against Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction, that's some achievement, you think. I mean, and I think Glenn Close still hasn't won an Oscar, which seems amazing. But yeah, and I think Meryl Streep was also in the category, and yeah, and Holly Hunter for Broadcast News, which is another fantastic performance. So she did really well. You know, it was an amazing thing to have happened.
Yeah, and when you think of, it's a shame that the only sort of main actor that wasn't nominated was Nicolas Cage, because even Vincent Gardenia, who played Cosmo, he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Yes.
But lost out to Sean Connery. Was, you know.
Oh, really?
Only human. Sean Connery's Irish accent in The Untouchables, but I mean that was a strong film. I mean, when you look at what it was up against, and yes, it didn't win Best Picture, but you know, I'm so used to dwelling in the category of movies of Razzies rather than Oscars. It's nice to watch something that's actually good, or at least fondly remembered.
Yes, and it's strange, because I think at the time the studio didn't know how to market it, because they didn't know what category it fell under, and so instead they gave Overboard, which is the Goldie Hawn film, a big push, and then people didn't like it that much, so it was only after that started to flail that they decided to give Moonstruck a bit more of a push, and then it was this huge hit. So it could have very easily just gone under the radar, you know.
Mm. But it also shows that, you know, again, with the benefit of hindsight, looking back at things like test screenings, where one of the trivia bits I read about this was they opened with part of the music from La Boheme.
Yes.
Have I said that right? I'm completely uncultured.
Yeah.
You can tell, well, I grew up on my estate, that wasn't something we talked about a lot. And yet in the test screening, that was the opening originally, and it scored really badly because the people who came to see the film were worried that they were there to see some arty film or something like that, and they ended up sticking Dean Martin at the beginning just to kind of reassure them a little bit. And I guess it's one of those where, and we've talked about it on other episodes, and that where, you know, this film these days might struggle to find its place even more, because it's not a huge franchise movie, and it's not a small, tiny independent thing that might flourish on a different circuit. I mean, bear in mind, in the UK, it didn't even get a cinema release.
So. No, it's extraordinary. It's interesting about the opera thing as well, because I wondered whether because I think my favourite bit of Pretty Woman is the bit where they go to the opera.
Hmm.
And I wondered whether that bit in Pretty Woman had been inspired by the scene in the opera in Moonstruck at all, because they have the whole thing of her reacting to the emotion of the opera so strongly. And I think with this, it was meant to kind of illustrate, because La Boheme is a really, really tragic opera, but the woman in it ends up dying of tuberculosis, I think. But this idea that the music is so beautiful that it's kind of about the journey that the music takes you on. And so even though it does end in tragedy, it's worth it because the feeling in the music is so great. And so the kind of the message of the film, if there is a message, is kind of meant to be something similar. You know? So, go with the emotion, don't go with the logic.
So, yeah. I mean, the whole scene where Ronnie and Loretta go to the opera. Yeah, she's dressed like $1,000, $1 million. Even that's $1,000 sounds a bit vague. And Ronnie turns up, and you think, like, this is a guy who obviously makes a huge effort. And you know, yes, we've previously only really seen him in a vest sweating away in a baker's oven. And he's turned up, and I think I saw one of the I think the label for his coat said Calvin Klein on. So I'm not sure what sort of outlet villages they had in Brooklyn at the time. But he's, you know, he's obviously saved his pennies from living above the bakery. And this, you know, this isn't a Greggs. This is a proper family bakery.
Yeah.
You know, and it must be weird. I mean, this is, in a way, their first date, albeit they've been up to stuff previously. Oh, that makes me sound really old. Up to stuff, like shenanigans. And, you know, for a date, I mean, that's, you know, turning up in a dinner suit and a tuxedo and she's dressed like that. I mean, this isn't like an online dating thing where it's like, right, I'm wearing the green trainers and I'll meet you under the clock. This is going to the Met to see, you know, a proper opera.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it just looks like that's putting a lot of pressure on Joe Public, you know, when they turn up and, I want to take me out and show me the town, and yeah, I'll take you to La Boheme, and you end up going to the local multiplex and maybe a Frankie and Benny's afterwards.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, I mean, not at all. Got the voucher. Yeah.
Do you think it's meant to imply that he knows that you know she's going to be his great love, so he's going to spend his savings, certain amount of his savings, on going to the opera that one night?
And so, well, it's worth that kind of investment. He must have had two tickets, and who else would he have taken? It's strange that, again, you know, it's almost like it portrays opera in a way that, I don't know, you can just turn up to a football match or a concert in London and just buy a ticket on the door and not have to pay six times the price on some, one of those dodgy second resale sites. But yeah, I mean, again, it shows him as passionate about stuff and he takes things seriously, and despite the fact that he's probably less than half the age of her fiance, he is more grown up in a way.
Yes, because he's able to feel through, you know, he likes his culture, he likes his art, and it does imply there is something about being able to connect with music or with any form of art that implies that you're in touch with your feelings and you're kind of you're in a dialogue on some level, doesn't it? So you're right in that it does actually, even though he's been kind of ranting and raving,
yeah,
it implies that he's more in touch with his thoughts and his feelings possibly than his brother is, you know.
Yeah.
His brother seems much more all over the place in terms of what he wants, because he proposes and then backs out on it and just is much more erratic, actually, than Ronnie is in some ways.
Yeah, there's the whole premise that he'll only marry Loretta if his mother dies. And, you know, again, that becomes apparent later on when she has a sudden improvement in health and all of a sudden the wedding's off. I mean, again, it just shows, I don't know, I mean, you know, having an Irish mother rather than an Italian mother, I don't know. I mean, she, you know, my mother quite liked the prospect of a wedding and the chance to wear a new hat and all that,
yeah.
Do all the hyacinth bouquet kind of routine. But it's, yeah, it's a weird one. Again, it just shows the difference between the pair, and you can't imagine Johnny being too emotional about anything. And, you know, whereas Nicolas Cage being Nicolas Cage will get emotional and about the opera and really get involved in it. And I suppose in some ways a lot of people would like a partner who has a passion in that sort of thing. And,
oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
They have a lovely touch with Johnny where he's on his way back and he keeps leaving his suitcases behind. Mm. Gets into the taxi and he's left them behind. And you get, you know, they put across really well his kind of, He's not really focused on Loretta. That's the thing. They betray something quite well, which I think is common between people that pair up sometimes. It's not that there's any bad feeling there. It's not that you really dislike each other. Just sometimes it's not right because neither of you are really focused on it. You know, it's just, you can tell that his emotional intensity lies more with his mother than with the idea of, you know, getting back to Loretta or anything like that. And they portray that in quite a comical way, I think. Quite,
yeah, happy. And it works well. And the whole, I mean, we've kind of almost skipped over the fact that Loretta's dad was at the same opera with his date you know, very garishly dressed in pink. But again, this was him leading his second life. You know, we've already established that Loretta's mum knows that this affair is going on, and you know, Loretta almost doesn't believe her, but then she sees them together and it's all very awkward, and it's, you know, you've almost got a, you know, a couple of close encounters during the interval of the opera where they kind of almost walk past each other, and they're in, I think the guys are in the queue for the drinks at the same time, the ladies are in the ladies' room at the same time, and it's all just, that's about as close as it descends to any sort of farce, but not taking it too far at all.
Yeah, completely. And it shows how at the opera there are these different things going on where Loretta and Ronnie are having their, you know, their first proper date, and there's so much feeling there and it's so incredibly romantic, and then it kind of brings you up short when you see that her dad's there as well, because they've got this recurring theme throughout the film about, you know, this theory that Rose has about, well, actually, yeah, I think that Johnny actually introduces to her, which is that the reason that Cher's dad is doing this is because he just, you know, he wants to avoid thoughts of his own mortality, basically. He's just trying to distract himself. And so, you know, buying his mistress a neck, a bracelet, or going to the opera is actually just a sort of, you know, just a displacement activity. It's just him trying to distract himself from the fact that he's getting older. And yeah, so it shows that not all dates to the opera are kind of, you know, a profound experiences. Some of them are just people sort of, you know, trying to avoid the problems in their lives. So
yeah, if this was first dates, they wouldn't be necessarily seeing each other again at the end of it.
No, exactly.
And all the while this is going on, Cher's mum goes out for dinner at the local Italian, and we see for the second time Fraser's dad, or John Mahoney to give him his actual name, having a date with a younger woman, which goes incredibly badly. He gets drinks thrown over him at every opportunity. They end up dining together, and he's quite kind of, I say, cheeky in this way. He's got this almost, there's an element of not wanting to get old. That's almost like that Fonzie kind of thing in a slightly weird way, where she talks to him about stuff, and the way that, because he's a university teacher or lecturer and most of these girls are his students, and it's almost like he goes on dates with them because, well, what else am I going to do? That's what you do. You're a lecturer, you go out with your younger students. I mean, who cares about, you know, abuse of power or any kind of awkwardness around that? And it's a weird kind of caveat where she spends an evening with him and she sees a slightly different life and someone who seems keen on her. But to be honest, he gives off this air that he'd quite happily go off with anyone at that stage.
Yeah.
He's begging to go up to her house.
Yeah, or that he's kind of in, you know, he finds her, something about her wisdom and the kind of life experience that she has kind of not a novelty if he's only sort of going out with people that are way younger than he is. And it's interesting because apparently that restaurant is an actual place, and his character was based on a real person, where the writer would see that happened to him all the time, him getting drinks thrown at him from his younger students, you know. And I think that phenomenon is quite common. Abuses of power going on all over the place.
You say that like it's a bad thing. I don't know.
John Mahoney is so, one of my favourite actors, so twinkly. There are so many episodes of Frasier where Frasier likes a girl and then the girl ends up being into his dad rather than him. And every time you go, well, you know, she's only human. He's just a really kind of real but very charming actor.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And again, that's one of those things that when he passed away, was it two years ago maybe? And yes, a lot of people knew him from Frasier, but, you know, people knew him from all sorts. And you know, again, people were referring to his role in this, which was, you know, very much a supporting role and yet fondly remembered, you know, because he was this, you know, he played a role in the relationship between Rose and Cosmo.
Yes.
He kind of almost reminded her of why she's still married, but she still enjoyed her evening. And I guess that's almost a case for, you know, the whole premise of When Harry Met Sally, and can a man and woman be platonic friends? You know, he still wanted to come up to her house at the end of the so-called date.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up When Harry Met Sally, because I was thinking about how when Harry Met Sally, you have the action interspersed with the footage of these older couples who've been happily together, and they talk about how they met and the history between them, and how Moonstruck is sort of like that, but kind of the opposite, in the sense you get these little shots of people that are a bit older than the leads, who, you know, who've maybe not handled their marriage perfectly, or you know, or have not settled down at all, as in John Mahoney's character's case, where and he's just kind of chasing after younger women. And so it's funny, it kind of plays out in a different way, doesn't it, like all of these other kind of cautionary tales. So the John Mahoney's originally from Blackpool. I always think it's so interesting that he's actually a British actor.
And then when you think about him and Jane Leaves in Frasier as well, who was from Lancashire or somewhere in the northwest, I think. And you know, the fact that they went and ended up playing in Frasier. Of course, she had a very brief cameo in Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, so throwback to a previous episode. But
yes.
Yeah, it's strange, you know, these us Brits get everywhere, as they say. But
yeah, completely. Yeah. Have you done Say Anything yet? Because he's in that, isn't he?
Oh, is it? No, I haven't done that one yet. Oh, I need to. I think that's one of the ones we said we'd do, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, that's a really great piece. He's great in that as well. Yeah. I think the first time I ever saw him was in the film Reality Bites, actually, which I'm
okay.
So yes, yeah. he really had a, he kind of, he only got kind of noticed kind of later in life, but then he really got given some great roles. So
there's hope for us all.
Exactly.
That's like when I say about my football career, I'm 40 now and I still think, oh, I could still make it. Yeah. There's still a chance.
Definitely. Yeah, go. Yeah,
of course. Yeah. and of course, all this leads to, we do also have this say where Cosmo's dad sees Rose and Fraser's dad they're walking home. So he kind of gives this disapproving look, and you wonder where that's going. Because he lives in a house with his fleet of dogs. I think he had six, I counted.
Did you have any dog thoughts? You're the dog expert.
Well, I'm amazed that he would have six, can walk them all in one go. I suppose they are quite small. But one of them, I felt really sorry. One of them, when they ran in and ran up the stairs, one of them kind of took a bit of a stumble on the stairs. But I mean, trying to walk six dogs at the same time. I mean, I've got a large Labrador who, you know, when he is focused on what he wants, he's quite hard to manage on his own. Seven stone of him trying to pull me over to the tennis courts is always a struggle in the morning. But this old fella walking six sort of dogs around Brooklyn, I mean, he's got the technique down, and I suppose in another life he could have made quite a bit of money as a dog walker. But,
completely.
And they all live in that house, which must be noisy and very smelly.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I heard that there was something about Italian tradition where, I'm not sure if it's where the older the person is, the nearer the top of the house they reside in.
Oh, really? Okay.
I might have made that up, but yeah, so that's why he's at the top.
I wonder if that's like a hierarchy thing or something like that.
Yes, yes, it must be.
Okay.
But I like the way we see him going around kind of watching all of this insanity play out in front of him, and just sort of shaking his head despairingly. Very effective.
And all of this is leading to the kind of climactic scene of the film where, you know, as we discussed earlier, it could be set in an Irish household. It could be, you know, obviously in a mostly Italian, or you imagine maybe a Greek house or something like that, where everything happens. The scene is all around the kitchen table. Yeah. You know, where that's where everything happens. I mean, that's where everything happens in my mum's house, especially, where that's where people sit down and talk and eat and you know, you don't sit in the living room. The living room's just for where you go and watch telly. And everyone's sitting around this, Loretta comes in, and of course there's food on the go. It's porridge in this case, oatmeal, which almost seems a bit disappointing compared to some of the other culinary treats we've been served, but it still looks decent.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Maybe it's there to create that feeling of, right, we've got to get down to business now. We've got to sort all of this stuff out. So there's going to be no eggs today. Apparently everyone kind of fell out over that last scene. You can see how it would have been quite difficult to direct because there's just so many people in one scene, and everyone had very different ideas about how it was going to work, and apparently Nicolas Cage threw a chair across the room and
it's almost in character.
Yeah, exactly. And Norman Jewison wouldn't let them go and have their lunch, so in the end the Screen Actors Guild did sue the film because, you know, you're not meant to do that and stuff. So, but I quite like the way you can sense a real sort of tension, and I think maybe it was, you know, possibly intentional on his part to kind of raise the tension to that degree, because it kind of lends itself to the action when they're all kind of trying to sort things out.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, again, you know, I've talked about certain films where you can almost picture them the way they were written, that could quite easily transfer to the stage or something like that. But, you know, having this setting and you've got people coming in from different angles where everyone's almost, you know, they're sitting there waiting for Johnny to come back and what's going to happen with him. And then the aunt and the uncle turn up because Loretta forgot to cash their money at the bank, and
yeah.
So of course they're there and, oh well, you know, let's join in, what's for breakfast, and then Johnny turns up, so it's a really busy kitchen already. And I mean, something I thought about was, you know, I mean, bear in mind this is probably what, a Saturday or Sunday morning, and you know, people are dressed quite smartly in some cases. You know, Johnny's turned up in a shirt and tie, and they're sitting there, and it's a very big kitchen because, you know, this isn't London, and yeah. But they're all, you know, still tense, and you've got Rose and Cosmo at different ends of the table. You know, that's their perches, almost, where they kind of oversee everything going on. But it's weird, sort of, you're expecting Johnny to come back, and when he does, but it doesn't quite go as you anticipate.
No, it's a strange, the twist then of Ronnie saying that. No, sorry, Johnny. Johnny saying that, you know, the wedding's off and all of the... And then also the fact that you have that incredible exchange between Rose and Cosmo. Actually, it's interesting because at that point you can see how John Patrick Shanley was... Obviously, he is a great playwright, and he wrote Doubt, which then they made into a film, you know, and he's written all of these things. And you can see how, when you're trying to film a scene that would actually lend itself to theatre really well, it's actually can be the kind of the hardest thing for a film director to do, because you've got to kind of home in on everyone's reactions so much and try and convey the kind of the inner life of everyone without, you know, there being kind of too much over dramatic action. Like, I love the thing where Cosmo slams his hand, you know, fist down on the table, and then he kind of sits down because she says you have to stop seeing her, and he slams his fist down, then he sits down and he says okay. And it's all sort of really nicely done. You have that underlying tension of it all, but people behaving actually, you know, how people kind of really do interact with each other in real life, I think.
Yeah, and even the obvious thing where, in a, I guess, it, not that I've been in many scenarios like this, but
yeah,
was it the uncle that someone said, oh, someone please tell a joke? just break that tension, please.
Yeah. Yeah, and the bit where he says, "Will you marry me?" and he says, "Do you love him?" and she says, "I love him awful." And she says, "Oh no, that's too bad." So good. He's got that. I want to quote Ronnie's speech that he makes to her.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. He says, Love don't make things nice. It ruins everything. It breaks your heart. It makes things a mess. We aren't here to make things perfect. Snowflakes are perfect. Stars are perfect. Not us. We are here to ruin ourselves and to break our hearts and love the wrong people and die. And I mean that the storybooks are bullshit. I want you to come upstairs with me and get in my bed.
You don't get that on Tinder, do you?
You really don't. You really don't. It's a great speech.
So I wrote down the thing where it says we're here to ruin ourselves, and I mean that could be taken the wrong way, but it just shows his whole, you know, throw caution to the wind side and everything, where, you know, he's throwing himself out there.
Yes.
And it's what I guess a lot of people would be scared to do it, and you don't want fear of rejection or whatever, but he's latched onto her and he's not letting go, and really being dramatic, but that's his thing and he's very good at it.
Yeah, and it's a very, even though it's obviously very articulate, but it's a very honest speech. It's not promising things he can't keep, you know. That's what makes it quite a hot speech, is that it's someone sort of saying, look, I'm not saying that everything's going to end up perfectly, you know, but we're not perfect. No one's perfect. We just need to live for the moment. So it's not someone sort of saying, manipulating Loretta, you know, it's just like, let's go for it and see what happens. You know?
Yeah. Only in the films, I don't know. And at the kitchen table, Johnny does return. And suddenly he kind of makes everything a lot easier by saying he can't marry her because his mum will die if she does. And she says, I just love the thing she says to him, I'll come to your funeral in a red dress.
That's so fantastic.
You know, he's solved her problem to some extent, and yet she's still angry.
Loretta, I can't marry you.
What?
If I marry you, my mother will die.
What the hell are you talking about? We're engaged.
Loretta, what are you talking
about? I'm talking about a promise, okay? He proposed.
Because my mother was dying, and now she's not.
Oh, Johnny, you're 42 years old. She's still running your life.
And you are a son who doesn't love his mother.
You are a big liar, okay? Because I have a ring right here.
Oh, I must ask for that back.
All right, the engagement is off.
In time, you will see that this is the best thing.
In time, you'll drop dead, and I'll come to your funeral in a red dress.
I think that's very realistic, though, because people, you know, she will have been saying to herself, oh, no, I'm going to have to let this guy down. Mm. He's going to be so devastated. Then when he's like, you know, oh, actually, by the way, I don't want to marry you anyway. And he says it in front of everyone, you know, and you kind of think, oh, yeah, your ego would be a bit bruised by that, wouldn't it? Yeah. So, yeah.
And I suppose the weird thing where Ronnie then proposes to Loretta, borrows the ring that she'd just given back to Johnny.
Yeah,
and there's this, and probably my favourite bit of the whole film, where the grandfather sits down tearfully and goes, "What's wrong? I'm confused. What's going on?"
No, it's so good.
Oh, so the way, just kind of, unless you've sat there and had the privilege of having it on a film in front of you explaining, you've seen everything, you know, if you're coming down, he's already late to the scene because I think he came down halfway through breakfast.
Yes.
And he's just going, what's going on? I've just come down for breakfast. Why is this person here? Why is that person here? Why is everyone being all teary and emotional? And imagine next time I come down for a bowl of cornflakes. And
oh, but fantastic. I mean, obviously things like that don't play out in exactly that way very often. But it is true, though, that who people fall for isn't anything you can ever predict. You can't predict it for yourself, and you can't predict it for the people that you know. And that actually, if someone at the end of your life, told you, kind of went through everything that had happened to you and the people you knew, you would probably end up saying, oh God, I'm confused, you know. All of that was so unpredictable, you know. So it does have this kind of wildness to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that whole soap opera thing where, you know, it's, oh, I saw that coming a mile off, and you don't see this coming at all. I mean, yes, you anticipate that Ronnie and Loretta will end up together, but it's more the journey than the destination. But and the touching bit, I think I pointed out at the beginning, where, you know, at the end when they're all lovey-dovey, everyone's really happy, and Johnny's sitting in the background looking very depressed, and they take him over a drink and say, you know, you join in, your family, this still makes you family. You know, you may not be Loretta's husband, but you'll still be her brother-in-law.
I find that really moving.
You wouldn't expect that in real life.
No, although it is something, as you say, that you're we're both from Irish families, and you have that sentiment does run through Irish families quite strongly, I think, that thing of kind of, you know, you need to make people feel welcome, and and actually, as a film, I think that the note it leaves you on actually is kind of less about, you know, romantic love will solve all your problems, and it's a bit more about family, about you know, just that idea of yeah, just kind of everyone kind of mutually sort of supporting each other, even if you're kind of, you know, behaving quite badly or quite erratically, that, you know, that you can all kind of love each other anyway, you know.
Yeah, because again, you know, it shows the sort of tight-knit side of the community where everyone knows who Johnny is. When she says she's marrying Johnny, it's like, oh, he's no good. There's the, you know, they know him, they know the family. And again, it's almost like, you know, again, the easy comparison with them and an Irish town or something like that, where, you know, families do know each other and different generations know each other. And again, there's the magnanimous way of doing it and having him involved, or it gets awkward. And, you know, as we said, you know, he's not a bad guy at all.
Yeah, completely.
You know, and it is nice that he gets welcomed back. And I'm sure, yes, it might be awkward, but
yeah, and, you know, he might just be someone that wants to live a bachelor, and that's fine. You know, it's better that he called off the wedding than try to get her to marry him, you know, when it clearly wasn't what either of them wanted to do, you know, so.
He's such, they're all such believers in sort of superstition and bad luck, that if he's worried that marrying Loretta would kill his mum, then it's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
We went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah. I like it. That scene earlier on where Loretta's being quite exasperated with him when he phones her from his mother's deathbed. There's a lot of Loretta. That's another thing about Loretta in this film, as a lead woman in a romantic comedy, is she's quite, and you can tell that she's a bit kind of nervous about too much sentiment, and she actually, you know, I think she's a bit sort of down on the flowers at the beginning of the film, and then she's a bit down on the Chagall painting that they see at the opera, and she's a bit sort of nervous around Johnny's emotional feelings about his mother, and that's another thing that you kind of feel like she's been persuaded to open up at the end of the film to the possibility of kind of, you know, maybe being a little bit soppy herself when she's been pushing it away the whole time. Which
also, well, I suppose being a mother's boy isn't necessarily an aphrodisiac.
Well, you know, he's obviously, as I say, he is obviously much more taken with his mother than he is with Loretta. And that is certainly not an aphrodisiac, it's true.
He seems happy.
He does. Absolutely.
Well, that was Moonstruck. And I must say, thank you very much for bringing the video, because I enjoyed it a lot. And I'm disappointed in myself for not having seen it before. But again, like a lot of things, I'm probably glad I'm getting to sit here and watch it now with open eyes rather than seeing it at 16 going, what a load of rubbish, which I might well have done.
No, it's true. I think it does enhance your appreciation of it, doesn't it, if you've got a few experiences behind you first.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. Yeah, I'm a very, very clean boy. But I guess, you know, I can only put myself in Cher's position and try and get myself someone of around 22, 23 years old who works in a local bakery. But again, my local bakery is a Greg's. So.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, free sausage rolls.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Katrin, thank you very much for bringing this. We'll get it rewound and return it. Now, where can people find you on social media, and what can they expect?
Well, if I've got anything to promote, I'll be talking about it on Twitter and on Instagram. I'm at Kitty Costanza. We're still kind of in, the theatre community is still in lockdown at the moment, so it's all it's all a bit quiet. But one company that people can keep their eye on as well is a company that I've been involved with in the past, and they're called Chippy Lane, and they're a group of London-based Welsh theatre makers, and they're at Chippy Lane Prod, and they've been creating some great content during lockdown, and they'll no doubt continue to do so once things are safe enough for everything to open up again. So
lovely. And we must support our arts, because yes. Yeah, what else have we got?
exactly. Well, podcasts like this, I have to say, have been a real lifeline for me during these last few months, so we're all very grateful to you, Rich, for turning out content like this.
Content. Yeah. and again, if people haven't listened, the other main episode that you appeared on, A Fish Called Wanda, is available. It's episode 61 or 62, and that was that came out at the start of the year, and that was a really good fun one as well. So if you enjoyed this, then go back and watch that, because we had a lot of fun doing that as well. So.
Oh yeah, that was great fun. I can't wait to hear the Desperately Seeking season one. It's one of my favourite films. So
yeah. Well, as we discussed, this film didn't get a UK cinema release when it came out, and apparently it had a very minor re-release in 2019 somehow. I don't know how that turned up. So normally I play the number one song at the time, but because it's Cher, we need to play something. And I guess If I Could Turn Back Time came out the year after. So should I play that? Because we don't get much Cher on here.
No, you don't. And it's a real classic. So written by Dan Warren. Yeah, everyone loves that one.
Yeah, we'll stick that one on. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, Katrin, thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure.
Said the things I said, cries like a knife, it can cut deep inside. Words are like weapons, they wound sometimes. I didn't really mean to hurt you.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Gary West, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cullington, Christian Dees, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrell, Katrin Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger, Alan Viewings, Peter Climie, Tom Carr, James Kennedy, associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise and more.